Hello and welcome to the first OneLiner.com podcast from the Edinburgh International Film Festival 2010. I am Drew, and over there is Scott.
Hello.
And we're just going to fire right into it. Scott, would like you to get us started?
Okay, first up is The People versus George Lucas, and there's nothing so iconic for a generation of nerds as Star Wars, and I'll include myself amongst those. Not too many people have been happy with Lucas's recent fiddling with the original films, and that's without getting into the prequels and the Clone Wars. This film is the story of those people who feel they've been betrayed by George Lucas, and if this isn't a first world problem incarnate, I do not know what is. It takes the form of interviews with people weaned on the franchise, many of whom have taken their fandom to quite ridiculous extremes, combines it with some excellent animations and other such, if you'll pardon the term, user-generated content, things such as The Excellent Troops and other such animations that can be found around the place, clips from the Robot Chicken Star Wars specials, things like that. And it takes a look at how Lucas's original vision has informed a generation of cultural references and why tooling around with these cornerstones retrospectively might not be a particularly good idea. There's a few interesting points raised by the film, largely in regard to how culture can come to view an artwork once a film has been released and enjoyed, especially by so many people, such as Star Wars had, that for a lot of us it became an intrinsic part of our culture. Does it truly belong to the creator anymore?
Yes, because it becomes an ownership issue, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I think once it's been released and other people have, well, given you money for it, quite frankly, but as well as it being such a cultural impact, it doesn't really belong to George Lucas anymore, at least outside of copyright terms. Not something he's ever seemed to agree with.
I can see where you're coming from, and I agree with a lot of the points. I don't like what he's been doing with his stuff, but at the end of the day, it is his work, and it's, as the points made in the thing that in the film, that artists, you can put canvases through various scanners and see that artists have gone back and fiddled with their work at points somewhere between sort of the more or less final one and what it's been famous as now. But at the same time, obviously it annoys a lot of people, I mean, especially Craig Eastman of this parish. He was going to have t-shirts with Fuck Off George emblazoned on them at one point, but he didn't in the end, because like most people who have mortgages, they've learned the lessons of the Jedi. Let go, Luke. And any of people who aren't named Luke. Problem is that for a lot of this film, it does kind of whine about fairly well-off people whining about the things that you don't like from the CG enhancements in the first Star Wars films, and how it's a lot of complaints, all of which I more or less agree with, but all of them are very much first world problems, you know, oh, Jar Jar Binks, hand shot first, etc, etc. And there are people with real problems in the world, and frankly, what George Lucas decides to do with Star Wars really isn't one of them. The simple answer is, if you don't like what George is doing with the Star Wars franchise, stop giving him your money. But most of the people in this seem to be completely unable to stop doing that and just stop buying anything with Star Wars attached to it, which I suppose plays into coming to recommend this. If you are that sort of person, then you're going to watch the film anyway, regardless of what I say, because it's got Star Wars attached to it. And if you aren't, then you'll probably never hear about this film. So actual recommendations of it are somewhat unnecessary. There's a certain cathartic pleasure to be had from having essentially my own opinions as well sort of reinforced back to you. But at the same time, it's not really adding an awful lot to the discussion. It's an enjoyable enough film, and certainly if you're a Star Wars fan, you will get some enjoyment out of this. For the general populace, who perhaps are a bit more grounded in reality and don't try and automatically levitate something with their mind just for the hell of it, just to see if it'll work, I'd probably steer clear of it.
Okay, so next up we have Kickoff, a film set in the Iraqi city of Kirkuk, more specifically in an abandoned football stadium that a bunch of Kurdish and other minority peoples in Iraq were forced into after being forced out of their homes under Saddam Hussein's regime, and now having to suffer being homeless and the risk of being blown up in the mess after Saddam Hussein was deposed. The cast is mostly unknowns, the main character Asu being played by a Kurdish singer, looking very much like an Iraqi Nick Knowles, but fortunately with a better voice. The tale, such as it is relatively simple. It's just an insight into these people's lives, just the things they have hard going, but trying to maintain their cultural values and friendships, looking after their families. There's nothing particularly different there, and you've not seen in other films or documentaries about the poor people of the world, of which there are far too many. This is a bit different from, because Middle Eastern cinema is not that commonly shown in Britain, which, and I find it quite interesting because the culture is markedly different. So central to this film, as you may have guessed by the name Kick Off, is that ASU wants to create an amateur football tournament to bring all the differing ethnic groups together in an act of friendship to try and build some bridges. And it involves him trying to get sponsorship, trying to get football strips, that sort of thing. That doesn't sound particularly interesting. And story-wise, it's probably not. What is interesting is the look at another culture and simply people dealing with pretty shitty existence. There's definitely things of interest in this film. The characters are likeable, believable. The performances are quite natural. If you were to see it, I certainly wouldn't be put off by the rather scary typeface used for the title at the beginning, because it's more or less 99% of Comic Sans, which is a terrible font to use anywhere. But there's some interest in just the characters and their way of life and the different culture, which really is, a lot of it is very, very different from what most people here in Britain would see. There's not much to recommend it story-wise, though, and it doesn't have any particular messages. Whether it was meant to or not, I don't know. It just doesn't make it a particularly rewarding watch, interesting as it may be. It's also quite oddly shot. It's either black and white with a digital gradient to add colour, or I suspect it's colour film really, really, really processed to remove anything but the colour left in the most saturated colours in clothing and such. One place you do notice colour is in the football strips, and suggest that perhaps that's the one place in life where there's colour or hope. It's not really consistent enough for that to be the case, because you'll see colour pop up in just a regular shirt somewhere, or road signs. Although I may be willing to forgive that, certainly that may be a money thing to actually do it properly, so that it only showed up in the football matches. Might take a lot of time and money to do.
What you're saying is they had an Adobe Premiere plugin and they weren't afraid to use it.
Very possibly, yes. It's really not worth seeing. There's not enough of a story or a message in this to really make it stand out from anything. It's a fairly interesting group of people, but they don't do anything particularly interesting. It's not very happy, and there's a really, really weird bloke. I'm half convinced not all of this film was actually meant to be considered as having happened, because there's this bloke keeps appearing who has one missing lens in his sunglasses, is wearing a black suit, has a pet goat, and appears in every second or third scene to sit in the seats in the stadium and laugh maniacally. And I'm hoping that it wasn't just me that saw him.
Did you fall asleep during this film? It would explain an awful lot.
It would. I'm fairly certain that I didn't, but not only was the strange laughing goat suit man there, also this horse just suddenly appears in the middle of one of the football matches, and it seems decidedly trippy matched up with him. Don't bother going to see it, there are better films out there.
Okay, over to Greece now for Evil in the Time of Heroes, a Greek zombie film. Perhaps there's not an awful lot of avenues left to explore in the zombie canon, apart perhaps from an actual zombie canon. That would be awesome. But the distinguishing feature of this outing revolves around a fairly baffling, fractured narrative, although this may be due to me finding it difficult to focus on anything resembling a plot, given the prevalence of shaky cammed gore on display. There's a zombie outbreak in modern Athens. A group of survivors band together. Stop me if you've heard this before. The twist in the tale in this film comes from the occasional flashbacks to an ancient era Athens, where there's a similar outbreak for a group of soldiers to attempt to stab their way out of, and the prophecy that there's a chosen one to end the zombie threat. This may or may not have something to do with the modern day taxi driver who appears to have contracted a case of immortality. Now, it's not intended to be taken seriously, given that several of the characters have more in common with Jedi than they do in humans in terms of their ability. There's more than one occasion where the gore factor has been taken so far over the top that it's invaded Poland, but it does work to great comic effect in a number of cases. It's certainly an entertaining film, I'll give it that. It's not a good film, however. It's plainly filmed on a budget. There's more than the odd really cheap and nasty looking effect, but to be honest, none that look much cheaper than Romero's last effort in Survival of the Dead. What it lacks in quality, it more than makes up for in a kind of boundless enthusiasm, which on occasion is a blood-soaked joy to behold. It shares about as much DNA with video games like Left 4 Dead as it does zombie films, though, but this does make for an interesting watch. It's amusing enough to give a recommendation for genre fans. It's probably not worth making any extraordinary effort to track down, though. It's an amusing gore spectacle for those people who are into it. It's certainly not going to convert anyone to the cause, but if you do like a bit of zombie chomping action, then give it a look in.
I am, as you are, a fan of zombie films, and one of
like
the
all good-hearted people.
Hearts. One of the more interesting zombie films of late was one of the more interesting films from last year's festival, Ryan Denmark's Romeo and Juliet versus the Living Dead, which gets kudos simply for its awesome name alone. Having seen his name attached to another film at this year's festival, it seemed promising. The film in question is Chase the Slut, which isn't a pursuance of a prostitute, but is in fact about Chase, who, as the title suggests, is a slut. Quitting her dead-end job in a local diner, Chase attempts to make the grand exit and leave the town for good, only to find out that her shitbox car ain't working. Needing $1,500 to fix it and having only $4.32, she's talking with her friend Tibbs, the pretty rich girl, who, having fixed her hopes of marriage on the boy in the rust-coloured shirt, decides that she will pay Chase the money she needs to fix her car to sleep with this boy and break him in for her. So Chase takes this up because she's not shy about a bit of the old heave-ho, and deciding that being paid for all the sex she does might make quite a bit of sense to her, Chase agrees to Tibbs's request and starts investigating this boy. So to get a chance to sleep with him, because he's a good upright boy, she needs to seduce him. And to do that, she needs to find out something about him. And it turns out that Gabe is a member of quite an odd cult who worship household pets and sing to the household pets and get married because of the food chosen by the household pets. And, well, really, they're a bit odd. This being more or less of a romantic comedy, you'll be entirely unsurprised to hear that Chase falls in love with Gabe. The rest of it is fairly typical for this sort of fare. There's recrimination between her and her friend, there's problems in relationships, there's love, there's hate. Plot-wise, there's nothing particularly different. What is different from a lot of rom-coms that seem to have seen recently is that it is actually funny. It's quite uneven. It's definitely a sort of peaks and troughs sort of film, but for every sort of slower, less interesting piece where there's all the ridiculous soul-searching and angst going on, there are some brilliant visual asides that are just really, really funny. And it's a romantic comedy. I don't know what else I can really say about it other than that it's a romantic comedy that's quite funny, worth a watch, and you should bear in mind the name Ryan Denmark.
Yeah, I'm a little perturbed that I missed that one. Is it? You're saying this one sounds bitty, which is perhaps something you could say about Romeo and Juliet versus the Living Dead as well, when it hit a few really good jokes, but it was kind of uneven. Is this really the same? Has he improved any? Has he been a little more consistent here, or is it? I think he's developed any?
I don't know. Some of the cast are the same as Romeo and Juliet versus the Living Dead, so it makes it feel similar in some ways to where it differs from Romeo and Juliet versus the Living Dead, I think, is that while there were peaks and troughs, the problem I had was there was a fairly consistent level of funny throughout, and then it seemed to run out of ideas. Whereas this has funny bits all the way through, which is that it also has the rather dull, it's perhaps doing a disservice. Has he improved? Perhaps slightly. Silly, having spaced out the laughs, it means it does manage to fit in the full running time.
Good.
To keep the stand up for the full running time. It's no more than, say, a 3 out of 5 film, if you were to give it a rating. But it's entertaining enough. It's worth a watch. You're going to get a good few laughs out of it. What more do you want?
In The Road to Las Vegas, it is a documentary which focuses on the journey of an American family relocating from Alaska to Las Vegas in search of a better life. The Meltons are by no means a nuclear family, with the father, Maurice, having a recurring crack cocaine problem. The mother, Vanessa, probably has just about as many issues given that she keeps taking him back, despite him having either wrecked or sold some ridiculous number of cars, either while high or to get high. It was something like 16 cars, which is some kind of achievement. I don't know how this family survived and sort of stayed together in the way it has, up to the point where we start viewing them. It covers 5 years of the family's life. They're far from smooth, which, while tragic for those involved, at least make for reasonably captivating viewing. Entertaining viewing, but that seems to trivialise things a little bit too much. You know that things aren't going to be plain sailing from the outset when Vanessa declares that God told her to move in a dream, which for most people would suggest the course of medication rather than a road trip. Less charitable people than I would suggest that leaving with $200 and having your family, including 4 kids, live and sleep in a rented car for months would not seem to be particularly responsible or sensible. Recounting the further events would probably serve little purpose, so leave it there. The film is perfectly reasonable. It's by no means the most probing of documentaries, though. It recounts the events well enough, but I don't feel that I was given any particular insights into any of these characters. We don't really explore why Maurice keeps going back to the drugs, or why Vanessa keeps taking him back. They seem nice enough people, especially the kids, for what little time they're shown on screen, but it's not really enough reason to make a film about them. If I was going to go out on a limb, I'd assume the sort of subtitle of something like A Story of Boom and Bust is supposed to try and relate this back to American society as a whole, but if that's indeed what the director Jason Massett was trying to do, I think his reach has exceeded his grasp. It's not a dreadful film, but I mean, the only real positive that I take from it was a couple of very pretty shots of a landscape taken along the way of the American countryside, but that has very little relevance to the point of the film, and you could just see a couple of photos rather than that anyway. It doesn't really have any relevance to society as far as I can tell. It doesn't speak to any greater aspect of American culture, and to be honest, it's not really given a massive amount of insight into the people it's actually talking about. So on that basis, it's not something I can really recommend to anyone, despite the fact that, as I say, if you are sat in front of it, it's reasonably captivating viewing, but not something that really spoke to me on any great level.
That doesn't sound like the most interesting thing I've heard of.
As I say, I've seen far, far worse films at festivals and more films that have tried to do something and failed far worse than this film does, but that's no reason to recommend it.
Your choice on whether or not you'd want to watch our next film, World's Greatest Dad, depends on which Robin Williams you get, because yes, indeed, this is a Robin Williams film. Now, if you get the Robin Williams as seen in One Hour Photo, Insomnia, or Good Will Hunting, it's all good. Unfortunately, if you get the Patch Adams Robin Williams, you'd probably rather pull your eyes out than watch this. Fortunately, though, this Robin Williams is far more to the Good Will Hunting end of things. This is a story about a dad, unsurprisingly, who doesn't get on with his son, which is largely because his son's an arsehole. The film begins with seeing Robin Williams' life as a school teacher who aspires to become a writer, and at the same time trying to develop a relationship with his son. And then after a tragic accident involving autoerotic asphyxiation, his son dies and Robin Williams decides to cover up the rather ignominious departure of his son and make it seem like he'd committed suicide. He writes a deep and touching suicide note, which is later found by one of the students at his school, published in the school newspaper, and suddenly begins to affect everybody in the most ridiculous manner, really. The rest of the film deals with the aftermath of his son's death, how his writing career develops, how his relationships develop.
The rest of the film is just concerned with the text of the suicide note, having the kids bond together and find new and interesting ways in which it relates to them, and also with Robin Williams' character, Lucas, his descent into slightly more dubious moral territory when he's trying to further his career by taking his son's name in vain, with the continual threat of being found out about what he's been up to.
Yeah, none of which sounds like the greatest bed for humour, but fortunately there is quite a bit in it, and it's oddly uplifting in places too. I'd say you could reasonably recommend this film. It's kind of touching and funny in places. You get a good dramatic performance from Robin Williams, for the most part anyway. There are slightly camp moments that seem out of place. The proviso you have to have with this film, though, is that you have to stick with it up till his son dies, at which point it suddenly becomes a much, much better film because his son spectacularly, universally, unremittingly unlikable.
Yeah.
And it's kind of strange to find that a film based on a father's grief about his son's death is actually massively more entertaining simply because his son is dead. It may sound cruel, but the kid is deeply unpleasant.
It's definitely a strange setup for a comedy, isn't it? From the deranged mind of Bobcat Goldthwait. I just like saying the name Bobcat Goldthwait. It's a good name
something
to say.
Something pleasant about the Thwait bit, isn't there?
Yeah, I more or less agree with that. My review's up on the site if you want to take a read at it, but yeah, I'll more or less echo all that. It's consistently pretty amusing. I don't think it's ever outright hilarious at too many points, but I've certainly sat through far worse comedies this year, and it's certainly enough to recommend it. Okay, I was drawn to our next film, Boy, by the CV of the director. He's previously helmed a few episodes of The Flight of the Conchords, which is as much of a stamp of quality as anyone should need. I suppose the obvious touchstone for this New Zealander film would be Whale Rider, although dumping it into the general category of coming-of-age tale is probably doing it a bit of a disservice. It's about a young boy who goes by the name of Boy, played by James Rolleston, or on occasion, Alamine, that being his real name. He lives with his grandmother, his younger brother Rocky, and several nieces in a humble farm. His mother's died some years previously, and his father is away on either a variety of exotic adventures, if you listen to Boy's imagination, or jail, if you're more of a reality-based type of guy. While Boy seems happy enough going through his life, things get a little bit more complicated when his father returns. Confusingly enough, he's also named Alamine, although he prefers to be called Shogun. He's now calling himself the leader of a gang called the Crazy Horses, although I'm not sure that three people really constitutes a gang. What follows is an exploration of the father-son bond, given an unusual twist in this case, inasmuch as Boy starts the film being far more responsible and grounded in reality than his father, who seems far more at home playing pretend soldiers than with his duties of fatherhood. At least these antics make for amusing viewing until we find out what Shogun's running from, reverting to adolescence to avoid dealing with certain issues. What Boy manages to do is capture wonderfully the grand fantasies of playful youth, the exuberance and the wild flights of imagination that have to be abandoned or at least curtailed in adulthood. It's greatly entertaining and very likeable movie. It's often hilarious, it's consistently well made, and on occasion packs a powerful emotional punch. If there is a failing in Boy, it's the role that the writer-director Taika Waititi has created for himself in the shape of Alamine's father, who, along with his gang members, are several shades too stupid to exist in reality. Taken as a broad caricature filtered through the eyes of a youngster, it's not so bad and it doesn't feel out of place in the context, but if you look at it any more closely, it tends to fall apart. It is, however, a very well-performed caricature, and one that's frequently very amusing. There are similarly excellent performances from the two young leads. There is a very solid case to say that this is not the best made or constructed film that will appear at this year's EIFF, but for me so far it's actually been the most enjoyable. It is largely captures the sort of innocence of youth better than anything I've seen in a long while. It's a fairly likeable story and the characters are interesting, and it's consistently funny, and that's pretty much a win as far as I'm concerned.
Yes, I don't see how you could possibly complain about any of that. Unfortunately, though, I could complain about quite a lot of the next film. Two Eyes Staring is a horror, nominally, and involves a little girl who lives with her mum and dad. Her mum inherits a house from the mother she hasn't seen in 20-odd years or so. The family up sticks, move to the house. Strange things begin to happen. The little girl gets affected by ghosties. Secrets are revealed about the mother's past, and it ends. There's genuinely not an awful lot more to say about this film. It's not, I don't like to say it's a particularly badly made film. It's shot well enough. I'm not sure about the acting in a couple of places, but I think perhaps because Dutch accents sound kind of unusual to my ears, that perhaps it's that rather than bad acting. I may be talking out of my bum there entirely, but that's the way I see it. The problem is, it's just really dull. As with most films of this type, it's not scary, it's not unsettling, I didn't feel in the least bit horrified or thrilled. It's just slow and boring, and I've seen too many films like that, and so I would absolutely not recommend anybody else saw it.
Yeah, it's pretty tedious, isn't it? It seemed to be trying to mix the sort of psychological horror and traditional scary, supernatural, woo, ghosty horror. And it doesn't really work. It's a bit too cliched. It's got my absolute normal pet hate of just having orchestras everywhere. This is the one film where you could possibly have tried to build up a kind of atmosphere just by having a house groan and creak the way that old houses do, with wind and dripping water and all that kind of thing. And that would probably work a lot better than just having an orchestra everywhere and playing quite badly. In a lot of places, it's not a pleasant sound at any point, and it's just cheap, and just having a loud orchestral stab to try and shock someone into jumping is just really amateur hour stuff, and the rest of it's just pretty boring. No, thank you, Drive Through. So we'll drive through to The Illusionist, which actually opened this year's Edinburgh International Film Festival. You'll probably remember Sylvain Chromey from Belleville Rendezvous from a few years back. Wonderful left field and superb animation. This is his first major feature since then. It's a very accomplished film, although in tone it's very different to his earlier work. Kicks off in Paris in 1959 with the titular illusionist, a stage magician, finding the audiences at the music halls dwindling along with the payouts. He heads off to London with his prop rabbit to attempt to further his career. This doesn't go much better, London not being any more fertile grounds for him than Paris, but he does wind up taking a gig in a small Hebridean pub where his act makes a big hit, and he gathers a groupie in the shape of a young teenage girl, Alice. Groupie's entirely the wrong word there. It's more of a kind of father-daughter relationship they've got going here. But Alice decides to follow him around when he leaves this Hebridean isle for Edinburgh. She's still labouring under the assumption that magic is real. So her illusionist finds a steady gig in a theatre. He continues his valiant efforts to stay relevant in a world that seems to be doing its best to try and obsolete him and all of his music hall co-acts, maintaining his profession and coping in a guardian-like way with the demands of the young girl turning into young woman is largely what the film revolves around. Much like Belleville Rendezvous, it's told in a very minimalist way. There's no dialogue to speak of. The character design is beautiful in Chromey's signature angular, unique and visually stimulating way. The backdrops are lovely and the story is touching. I'm in no doubt that this is a very good film. However, in stark contrast to Belleville Rendezvous, The Illusionist is really quite depressing. It's maybe a little far, especially given there's a lot of very nice comic moments, but it's just so interleaved with melancholy that it's almost overpowering, and it's more of a bitter ending than a bittersweet ending. But there's certainly a place for that in cinema, and the kind of downbeat nature of it makes for a welcome change of pace in animation, I suppose. Certainly Chromey is showing he can ably handle a more delicate tone with some skill. The Illusionist is definitely worthy of having a great fuss made over it, and it's a far, far more worthy film to open a festival than, say, The Edge of Love was a few years back. But it's certainly not going to have you in a party mood at the end of it. It's definitely, definitely a film worth seeing. I can only hope that this finds the same reasonably widespread audience that Belleville Rendezvous did, and I also hope that he doesn't wait so long to give us the next film.
Yeah, I don't have a lot of that. I really liked it, depressed as I was by many parts of it. Melancholy is exactly the word. It's just, as with the best hand-drawn animation, it's got charm.
Yeah.
Something that, to me anyway, just doesn't seem to be present in a lot of CGI animation. Now, I've no doubt that a lot of skill and hard work goes into making those, but they just never seem to have the charm that hand-drawn stuff does, and I don't know why.
Yeah.
I don't know what that special ingredient is, and this is up there with some of the best hand-drawn animation I've seen in the cinema in recent years. It's touching, as you say, Scott. It follows the same sort of thing that Belleville Rendezvous did, with having very, very little dialogue, and I really, really like that.
Yeah.
It's relying on character design and their movement and music cues and everything, and you're just filling in the rest with your head, and it's just kind of pleasing that, actually, just that the filmmakers trusted his audience to do that work and to get the film, the plot of the film themselves. Yeah, it's a very good film. One of the best seen at the Film Festival this year so far, and it's certainly one that you should make a point of going to see.
Indeed.
That's all from us for this episode. We will speak to you soon. If you want to get in contact with us, you can do so by emailing us at podcast@oneliner.com. But until next time, goodbye.
Ta-da. I'm so good.